Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to what has become a lovely annual tradition here on the Emperor Podcast. It is a podcast special dedicated to the BFI London Film Festival. This year's LFF is winding down this Sunday, October 20th, and so this is the perfect time to bring you a series of conversations that I've had over the last week or so with directors who have had work selected for the festival. And these are conversations about that work and about what it means for them to be selected for the London Film Festival and their memories and feelings and thoughts about the LFF over the years. First up, returning to the pod is the wonderful Nick Murphy, who directed the first episode of the new Stephen Knight, Stephen Graham TV show, A Thousand Blows, which was screened at the festival last week. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on this LFF celebration podcast, I'm going to call it. Nick Murphy, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm delighted to be celebrating with you.
It's nice. It's nice every year watching I've been watching the LFF grow and grow and grow over the years, Nick. And obviously, you live in London as well. What's it been like for you watching the LFF?
Well, it's my fourth thing I've had at the festival, and the first time you pinch yourself and you just feel. I mean, super privileged. I think people who aren't in the business probably think might assume we get sort of blasé or glib about these things. I think it's time to quit when you do. I think it's incredibly a privilege that not only do people gather and they walk on this silly red carpet and all that sort of stuff for it, but they want to come together and do more than just turn up to watch it. There's a sort of degree of celebration about it, and that's fantastic. And the festival has been. An incredible sport to me, an incredible sport to so many other filmmakers, and they are just so passionate about British cinema, British film, and British television now that it's sort of a credit to itself, really. And I know there are plenty of other festivals around. I've got to say, I've been slightly underwhelmed by some that don't appear to like cinema much, or rather the audiences don't want to like the show much, whatever. And I've always found, both in Toronto but particularly in London, audiences want to like the stuff. They lean in. And that's a sort of cultural thing that the festival have sort of planted in their audiences, really, and an enthusiasm for it that isn't as cynical as it is elsewhere, put it that way.
Yeah, it's always a real thrill whenever the LFF tickets go on sale, and I will watch people on Twitter talk about queues and getting caught in virtual queues, and just the fervor that it generates. People are prepared to do that, and pretty much every screening, unless I'm wrong about this, seems to sell out well in advance. There are people now exchanging tickets online, going, "I can't get into this one, but can you swap it over with this screening for me?" Because everything's gone. And that's really, really exciting. Yeah. There's such a passion you can feel.
I think there's I know you and I happen to support a certain Merseyside football team, the correct Merseyside football team. And you and I have talked in the past about the fact that that place could sell out three times. Yeah. And I think the festival's the same. The capacity could be, the enthusiasm is enormous. And that immediate sellout thing is terrific, to the point where even at something like a premiere like we're having with A Thousand Blows this evening, I can't get my family in. I mean, it's nor should I be able to. but it's hugely over capacity, and that's a mark of the enthusiasm itself. But as I say, even once they're in the room, there is just a gleeful engagement with everything, and even the films I go and see, which haven't been anything this year, but there's a sort of gleeful engagement with what the filmmakers are trying to do and why the festival are proud of it, and why the festival have picked them, and that's a credit to them as a festival.
It doesn't solely focus on movies; it focuses on TV shows as well. You're here with a TV show, with A Thousand Blows. Can you talk about that? Explain what it is for people who may not have seen it yet.
A Thousand Blows is a Disney Plus show starring Stephen Graham and Malachi Kirby and Erin Doherty. And it's written by Stephen Peaky Blinders Knight. And it is set in a very Steve Knight way. It is set in the murky, quite fun world of bare-knuckle boxing in Victorian England. And what Steve has done... he's taken loosely some real characters it centers on two guys from Jamaica who arrived in the 1880s and got to London and got it wound up in the bare knuckle boxing world of Wapping in East London and the criminal underworld. But then the gentrification of boxing began, and that the it slid west and gloves were applied and the world expanded for them. But the crime went with them. So it is, and the crime followed them, I should say. So it's an absolute romp. And I don't know of another writer who could write it in quite the same way. Steve Knight writes in this sort of eloquent, wordsmith way, a sort of an elevated way. And that tonally was something I've always been keen to match and myself and the other directors in the way we delivered this. The whole show is about an inch off the ground. It's got a great sense of fun about it. It's blood. There's plenty of blood, plenty of fun. And everybody in this world is fighting for their lives in more ways than one. And so the intricacies of all of that are just sort of delivered with a slight nod to a slight wink to the audience and a great sense of fun and plenty of bloodshed.
But it's great that it's at the LFF because you are a very cinematic director. You work in TV a lot, but your approach to TV is very, very cinematic.
We often sit around and talk. Thank you. We often sit around and talk about things wanting to be cinematic. We hear this from execs. We want it to be cinematic. And I'm not sure many of them often understand what that means. And I think they often, I suspect they think it means bigger wide shots and grander scale, which is absolutely not what cinema needs to be. I heard it described the other day. Francis Coppola, you've probably never heard of him, this little minor filmmaker who's emerged recently, talking about the unit of currency in television tends to be the word, the written word, the spoken word, and the unit of currency in cinema is the shot. And I think while there are always examples where that isn't the case, I think broadly that's a really nice way of framing it. And I suppose I don't set out to make my work cinematic, but I just do think in pictures and I think in the expressiveness of pictures. So where I'm a huge fan of a broad church of directors, I think I come down with Peter Weir and Sidney Lumet and these directors who were very exact about what the shot is doing, the Bertolucci, what the shot is doing, what is it expressing about the scene. And I think that is what ends up making my stuff perhaps more cinematic. And I was here a couple of years ago at the London Film Festival with another show called Spy Among Friends, and that was very much the same sort of thing. And I got a lot of people mentioning it feels like a Cassavetes film. Well, Cassavetes isn't big wide shots. Cassavetes is unmistakably cinematic. And I think the nature of the way in which you tell stories is what tends to be cinematic. So while I don't sit there and say, I want to make it cinematic, I do acknowledge what you say is probably true. A lot of my TV does feel a bit more cinematic than it might, because I don't think in the unit of currencies that perhaps a lot of other TV shows do.
Absolutely. And if people don't follow Nick on Twitter, he's a great follow. And a couple of years ago when Spy Among Friends came out, you shared your I don't know if you want to call it your lookbook, or certainly you shared your breakdown, your visual breakdown to how you were tackling that show and other shows you've directed in the past as well. And I think something that really stands out for me is that dedication and the time you put into the visuals, but also your approach to color. Something like Save Me, the first season of Save Me, for example, talking about the color and the yellow jacket, Lenny's yellow jacket that pops throughout that. That's something that's very, very important to you. So that's one of the things I mean when I say you're cinematic.
Yeah, I mean in the case of Save Me, the yellow jacket, we color coded quite a lot of the story really, and while he wore this popped yellow jacket the whole time, blue was a sign of color of grief. If people were wearing blue, if people were wearing red, they were a threat. You only realize this at the end. That's a spoiler alert. Anybody that turns up wearing red, suspect them. So yes, I like playing games with color, but also when you are telling a story in working class East London, and which traditionally shown as sort of gritty and difficult and awkward and all that sort of stuff, color was a way of popping the screen without leaving reality, because of course there is color in that world, in that part of the world. But I think any sort of project needs a central defining visual description, and they I don't know if that is afforded directors very often in television. I think a lot of directors are just asked to sort of get in there, cover it. Let's get coverage, and then sorted out in the edit. And I think that dilutes things and stops things feeling cinematic. And I think cinematic feel comes from clear decision making based on a credo that you've applied that you have taken from the script. I have to say it's got to come from the script, otherwise it's just the director and the DP showing off.
So what's your central defining visual approach or premise for A Thousand Blows?
There's something Steve said about everybody fighting for life. I said, what do you, when I'm working with a writer, I often ask, what's the simple questions. When I was working with Save Me, I asked Lenny, what's the song? What song do you think of when you think of Save Me? And he talked about the Specials. I didn't end up using that track in the titles, but I ended up using a Specials track in the titles. And with Steve, I said, how do you sum it up as briefly as possible? The kernel of what it's actually about, because the kernel of any writing isn't, okay, it's a bank job. You can say it's a bank job. People rob a bank, but it's actually about brotherhood, or it's about a man falling out of love with his country, or whatever. There is a kernel inside great writing that isn't just the plot. And he said, it's fighting for life. And that led to a sort of, okay, well, there needs to be a sort of proximity of danger, a proximity of the slip and fall in any situation, where that not only presents a jeopardy for the characters, but it presents a motivation about why the characters might behave in what ostensibly unreasonable ways, because they dare not fail. And we're in a world in the 1880s where in Wapping in East London, you dare not fail. And if that's true of any of the characters, it's unbelievably true of the two Jamaican characters, Hezekiah and his pal who come into it with naivety, but just this huge sort of risk they're running. And you know, Alec and Hezekiah meet that head on, you know.
And this is, of course, a reunion for you. You've worked with Steve Knight before. You've worked with Stephen Graham before as well. Do you chat about the Reds a lot with Stephen Graham, or is it very much work?
Steve, with work. No, we talk. I know Stephen and his wife Hannah, who produces on it as well, really well. Over the years, we've become obviously very close friends. We talk about Steve has now taken to not really watching Liverpool games because it's too tense for him, and he gets too invested. And he now lives a life of such equilibrium. He's so careful to control the equilibrium in his life, and he's such an incredibly pensive man. He reads profound works, and football disturbs that. So yeah, no, occasionally we do, but we don't. We certainly couldn't risk watching a game together. And the last time I engaged in full on football engagement with Steve was in a snowy field shooting Christmas Carol, where we got news that Trent Alexander-Arnold had taken an early corner against a corner taken quickly against Barcelona. And while the cameras are running, Steve and I are jumping around at this just off frame. You can see his chains of his costume. He was playing Marley. We're shaking, and the crew were just waiting for us to calm down. So Steve and I take it way too seriously, and we're better to not talk about football. So but we've got a sec. You hear this a lot. We now have a great shorthand together. There's so much we understand about each other's working patterns. And I know how to note him, and he very, very much wants noting. He's a director that lives off the input of a director. He's an actor that lives off the input of a director, but that's become such a shorthand now. And I know his process. I know he's got to circle back and go there in order to circle back to what we want it to be and all that sort of stuff. And that becomes incredibly comfortable. It's a little tricky for others around to understand. They think, well, why is this happening? Why was that totally different? And Steve's an actor that doesn't, he can't do two takes exactly the same. He's just not interested in doing that. He works so much on intuition and heart that you can't go in. If you note that sort of thing and say, do it again, you'll sort of break it. You need to communicate with him in a way that's sympathetic to the intuitive way he works.
Well, I'm glad to go in a second, Nick, because tonight you are preparing for the world premiere at the LFF. So let's bring it back to the LFF to finish off. Tonight's going to be a very, very special evening, of course. But what was your first experience at the LFF? You said you've had a few things there over the years.
It was in 2000, and I want to say 2011, my debut movie, The Awakening, was at the London Film Festival with Rebecca Hall and Imelda Staunton. And Dominic West. And I loved it. I couldn't believe it. My dad was alive in those days, and he and mum came. And that's quite something when you've, without getting gushy, when a few years earlier, not long earlier, you've told your dad, who's an office manager, you know, reliable income, that you want to go and do this, you know, I want to make movies, I want to make TV or whatever it be. That's quite a punt. And for him to see, I don't know, you and I know that the red carpets and black cars and everything is ephemeral silliness that just surround the publicity of a movie. To somebody who's not in the industry, and certainly to Dad, it absolutely wasn't. It meant, you know, he was very ill by then, very ill. And it meant, you know, his boy had done it, sort of thing, even though, you know, you and I know that doesn't actually necessarily mean that, but to him, and he died 5 weeks later. So, I have an amazingly personal sort of attachment to the festival for that, if nothing else, that it was my last, chance to show my old fella, your boy hadn't done badly.
Oh, that's beautiful, Nick. That's absolutely beautiful. But, tonight, it's also going to be a hell of a celebration, even though your family will be outside with glasses held up against the wall.
Yeah. I might be able to sneak them in, but they'll be stuck on row A, 1, 2, and 3 or something. I might be able to sneak them in. But no, I'm delighted to be at the festival. It's a fantastic festival. The shows are so bloody popular and so oversold and so massively subscribed. It doesn't need me to big it up, but I'm delighted it's held in such affection, because it's culturally so important, and it never mattered more than right now. The arts are under incredible strain, and I'm pleased that the recent government announcement talking about the rebates for the tax credits for independent cinema are being extended to independent cinema, which is superb. But the arts have been under the cosh, and the arts education has been under a cosh for too long. And I think this idea of undervaluing the arts is perilously dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous. Try and live without the media. Try and without graphics, without art, without music, without poetry. Just try and do that for a couple of days. Everything comes tumbling down. So the festival is a great advocate and a great voice for talent and for diverse talent. And it's an absolute privilege to be among them.
Amazing. On that note, Nick Murphy, always a pleasure, sir. I'm going to let you go.
Up the Reds.
Up the Reds, and best of luck tonight. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Take care.
That was Nick Murphy, and next up is a director who is slightly less experienced at the LFF, but no less exciting. It's Sasha Nathwani, whose excellent debut film, Last Swim, will be out next year. I spoke to him when he was in Belgium about the London Film Festival. Go figure. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined in this LFF special podcast by Sasha Nathwani, the director of Last Swim. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. How are you doing, Chris?
Not too bad, not too bad. We're talking about the London Film Festival, but you're in Belgium at the moment, which is really confusing me.
So I was in London yesterday. I'm born and raised in London, and I live in London. But yeah, these festivals all seem to happen over the same 2 or 3 weeks. So yeah, there's one here in Belgium called Ghent Film Fest. So the film is having its Belgian premiere tonight. And I'll be back in London tomorrow for the LFF premiere on Monday.
Amazing. So, amazing. Yeah. Well, how does it feel to be in the eye of this storm where you're being pulled from pillar to post and festival to festival? And today it's London, tomorrow it's Ghent. Who knows where you'll be on Wednesday?
I'm loving it. I mean, like, this is my debut film. I knew from the age of 13 that I wanted to be a film director. It's taken me, like, you know, more than 20 years to get to this point of having my debut film in the can. So be able to screen it in places, you know, I've been to all corners of Europe so far this summer since the Berlinale. And then, of course, the big Kahuna London Film Festival very much feels like we're coming home. So it's a dream come true. Very much enjoying it and just trying to take it all in, really.
Because for people who haven't seen Last Swim, and that'll be, I guess, most people who are listening to this at the moment, it's very much a London film.
Yeah, it's a love letter to London, told from the perspective of this British Iranian girl who takes her friends on a poignant, nostalgic journey through London on A-level results day. Yeah, that's the elevator pitch.
Sold. Sold. Your film is now fully funded. You're ready to go. But it's a beautiful film for people who haven't seen it yet. It's a really, really beautiful film, and you can feel London in its pores. So it must really be extra impactful for you to be chosen and selected for the same thing, to be selected for the LFF.
Yeah, I mean, I've been going to LFF for as long as I can remember. And, you know, even when we were putting this film together, my DP and I, Olan, from 22, there was a week where we literally went to see a film nearly every day. So it's been a place for me that's been a kind of breeding ground of ideas and film exploration. And, you know, I particularly love the screenings at Royal Festival Hall. I don't know if you've seen anything in that massive 3,000 person venue. It's just such a visceral experience. So it's kind of like full circle. You know, I always knew my first film was going to be set in London, a coming of age story set in London, because growing up in the 90s, I was very aware of the fact that my own lived experience of London, I never saw on the big screen. I saw so many American coming of age stories and European coming of age stories, but nothing that represented the London that I knew, how I would spend a day in London, the way that I spoke when I was with my friends, a friendship circle like my own, I never saw depicted on the big screen. So it was kind of it was always the kind of goal to have my first film explore that, and also explore the energy of London in summer, which I think is very unique and, again, hasn't been documented. So, you know, it was born out of a frustration of sometimes things tending to look very grey and monochromatic. So to have done all of those things and then to be invited into the festival was just, it's really the perfect place to screen the film.
Two things about that. First of all, how difficult is it to make a movie in London these days, especially a first time film, especially a low budget movie? Was it difficult to get the funding for this?
So the film is fully independent. It's all basically lots of private backers coming together. We did try to garner the support of the public funders, and we got quite late in the application process. But we never got through. And the script was kind of being shopped around London, and it ended up falling onto the desk of a production company called Caviar, who have offices all around the world. And they'd done, you know, it's the production company that did Sound of Metal by Darius Marder. They've done a lot of great debuts. Diary of a Teenage Girl, Mariel Heller, and also Chloe Zhao's film, The Rider.
Oh, wow.
And tons of European films as well. They're originally a Belgian company, but they're now global. They had done films in all of their locations, but never anything in the UK. And they happened to be looking for something, and it just so happened that they really resonated with the script. But funding it was really hard, because their model was a European model of co-productions, and working in the UK is just, I mean, you asked me, it must be very difficult, or was it difficult? I think for any film to get made, it's a miracle, you know, especially in this economic climate. Obviously, there's a little bit of a boost the industry will receive now with the new tax break. It was extremely difficult, and especially on our budget as well.
And when you get a movie going, this may feel like a strange question, but do you have the confidence at this budget level that the money is there to last you through to the end of filming, or is it very much a bit of a scramble to finish filming?
So what happened, we actually had a few different budgets for this film. I'll just speak openly, but budget for this film was 1.2 million. And we had versions of this film with a higher budget, 1.5 or closer to 2, which is actually the sweet spot for a lot of British debuts. They tend to be towards the 2 figure. Anyway, about 6 months before we started shooting, we only had 750K in the can. In the account. Yeah, so we decided that we made a commitment to one another, me and my producers. My producers are all amazing, Campbell and Nisha Caviar and Helen and Bert and Sorka and James. We decided that we were going to make the film with the money we had. And you kind of need that kind of uncompromising, like, we will make this. attitude, because otherwise you're just going to be like living in this kind of film purgatory of, are we going to be greenlit? When will that happen? But the team were really experienced. The production company were really experienced. They also, besides films, they do music videos and commercials. And what they did with the film is they were able to leverage those relationships to ensure that as much money ended up on screen and wasn't being soaked up in other things.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I'm thank you for talking openly about it, because I think there's a lot of mystery surrounding the process and the budget process and how movies procure their budgets. And I think a lot of people listening to this will be really fascinated by that. Equally, I think people will be fascinated about the process of getting into the LFF. How can you talk us through that and how you actually?
Yeah, so we shot the film in the spring and summer of 2023. We were in post-production for the rest of that calendar year. We submitted the film to Berlin, or there's a British Council screening of films for all the big festivals. So if anyone trying to get their film into a festival, the woman who runs it is Catherine Bray, and you basically pay to have your films exhibited in a big screen. I think they do it on Stephen Street, BFI. And the program directors and festival coordinators will come to London and they'll watch like Britain's offering of films. Mm. So they'll have different. So we basically submitted to that, and we got a very quick response from the program director of the Berlinale for the Generation Strand, which is the strand of films for kind of youth-driven films, coming-of-age stories. We got into that, and then it was a rush to get the film actually ready and finished in order to make the deadline. You know, I also happened to become a father for the first time around that time as well. It was a pretty crazy period in my life. But yeah, we got the film finished, and we screened. And then while we were doing all of that, we were asked to open the strand of the festival. You know, it was just all these amazing things kept happening. So we had this wonderful premiere in Berlin. There's a 1,000-person auditorium, the kind of Haus der Kulturen was the name of the venue. And I think Kirsty Matheson happened to be in, I think she was at the premiere or she was at a subsequent screening. And I think if she was at the premiere, there was a really special atmosphere in the room that day, that night. The film is a very emotional film. It draws all kinds of emotional reactions, and it was just there was a special energy in the room, and I guess the story resonated with her, and she thought it would make sense that the film plays in London. So it happened very organically. That's how it came to be.
And you're in this period now, as you say, the Berlinale. You're now in Ghent, you're in London as well. What as a first-time filmmaker, what are you hoping for from this run of festivals in terms of impact for you? And also impact for the film itself.
So having come from music videos and commercials, you work in very like short bursts, and then suddenly you complete something and it goes out, often goes out on things like Instagram. People consume it on their phones, but it goes out to the whole world. And then with this, what I've really enjoyed is just being in a room full of people. And when we did the Berlin premiere, being in like 1,000-person auditorium was a very vulnerable place to be, but it's also exhilarating, and just honing in on what people are reacting to at the moments that people are getting emotional, or moments where people are laughing, or there's a couple of moments in the film where people kind of almost jump out of their seats. Mm. And just, that's just the most wonderful, you know, just being there and experiencing that. And doing the Q&As and seeing that the film is kind of leaving its own impression, particularly on young audiences, is just really wonderful. So really, you just want people to see the film, you know, and you want the film to live and kind of go on its own journey. And then what it does for us in terms of what happens next, well, we're trying to keep the team together that did Last Swim, and we've got a sophomore project in the works. It's a genre film. So hopefully off the back of this, the second film shouldn't be as challenging. So hopefully we'll just get to continue making films and telling stories.
And on Monday you're going to have your premiere. I think this is probably going out after your premiere. Yeah.
I'll be very hungover.
I'm very glad I'm interviewing you now. Not on Tuesday morning. Yeah. Sasha, how was last night? Oh god,
I had a very croaky voice. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to that? Well, what are you hoping for? What are you expecting from that?
Yeah,
that
no,
night?
I'm super excited because it's in London. All of our friends, most of the crew are from London, you know, it's like big, like London, like cast and crew. And a lot of us went to Berlin, but I mean, it'll be like coming. Lots of friends and family are going to be there. It's playing in NFT One, which is just such a beautiful space to screen a film. And yeah, that's just really excited to come bring the team back together, but also for friends and family to see what we've been working on the last few years, because they've read about it and they've heard about it. But that's the thing as well. The thing that I'm getting used to with film is you hear about things, but the film is being distributed by Vertigo, but it's not going to have its theatrical release until early next year. So people haven't had the opportunity to see it. So more and more people will get to see it at LFF. And that's what I'm looking forward to. Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm going to let you enjoy Ghent and have a great time there. And then when the film comes out next year, please come back on the pod and we can talk about the film in depth then as well.
Would love to. Thanks for having us, Chris. Appreciate it.
And that was Sasha Nathwani. Looking forward to having him back on the pod next year when the film is released officially, as indeed I am with our third and final director, Sadie Frost. You might, of course, know her best as an actress, but over the last few years, Frost has been ploughing a furrow as a director of documentaries, first about Mary Quant, and now about another 60s icon, Twiggy. The film's name? You guessed it. It's Twiggy. I caught up with Sadie on Zoom earlier this week, and her film premieres tonight, Friday, 18th of October, at the LFF. So here is our chat. We are delighted to be joined in this London Film Festival special podcast by the director of Twiggy, Sadie Frost. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm nursing a bit of a cold, so apologies for the sound of my voice, but I'm very good.
Excellent. Exciting times with the LFF launching right now?
It's very exciting. I mean, it was just madness that I did a talk last week, a Q&A with Mark Moden, and I was still, when I was doing the talk, I was saying I still hadn't finished the film last week, and the last day was Thursday, where we were just finishing the sound mix. So it's been 3 years, and it's been, I mean, I think when you're covering someone's life that spans, you know, 5-6 decades, it's there's a lot to get in there. So you really have to kind of, it's not something you can plan, and there was a lot of different people from all over the world that had to be in this documentary. So it took 3 years. So there's a lot of patience and sometimes frustrating times when things didn't unravel how they should. But the thing is, what I see from my experience of making documentaries, which I made the Mary Quant one before, mm-hmm. is, you know, you don't really know all the ingredients. You plan for certain things to happen and they never happen how you want. I always think the documentary on the documentary would be more... would be so interesting because the kind of things that go wrong, but that's the nature of the game, and that's why I love doing it.
Absolutely. But then where would you stop? It would be like a Russian doll, right? You'd have the documentary on the documentary on the documentary,
yeah,
and then
you would just
never ever stop. But it's fascinating. I mean, what you said there about Twiggy's life, and you know, Twiggy of course is an active participant in this, which is tremendous. And you had such, I'm guessing you had a lot of access to her. There's a lot of interviews with her in different locations, which is wonderful. But how do you pack it all into, you know, just over 90 minutes, just over 100 minutes, really? I mean, this could be a 4-hour, 5-hour documentary.
I know. That's the thing. It's kind of having that discipline to make the choices that you really feel people are going to be interested in, and then also doing her kind of worthy and showing each part of her life. So obviously, when she gets discovered when she was like 16 and one of the most famous people in the world, you know, that was huge, and all the archives amazing, but it was very important for me to include you know, what happened to her in the 70s and the 80s, and even now, you know, being the face of Charlotte Tilbury and still recording music and doing lots of things. And you know what she does is she kind of gives you know, she kind of gives women hope that she, you know, you can reinvent yourself, you can evolve, you can also be in the industry and have a successful relationship and still kind of be very much there for your family. I wanted to show the whole person. But yeah, I had to be very disciplined, and I kind of start off with a paper edit and kind of make my, you know, bullet points, things that I want. And everyone kind of looks at it in the beginning and they say, like, what does that mean? Like, what are you talking, you know, it doesn't only make sense to me. But the weird thing is when the actual film is finished, like both times, it actually kind of ended up pretty much what I kind of wrote on paper right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I think the thing is people, when they're making a documentary, they can kind of conform to certain conventions. But for me, I really want it to be uplifting, especially when I'm celebrating someone like Twiggy's life, and celebratory and beautiful and not just kind of the nuts and bolts of it. So I kind of include animation and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. So why Twiggy? I mean, obviously after the Mary Kwan documentary, you've become this inadvertent chronicler of this particular time for London and for England in this incredible moment of culture, this cultural revolution in a way. Was it a natural follow on in a way from Quant?
I think so. I mean, with Quant, when I got approached to direct that documentary, I was like, where would I start with this? And then I read her autobiography and completely felt like I knew this person. I think growing up in the 60s with my mum was like an actress, dressmaker. My dad was a psychedelic artist. I was in those places. I knew those things. And it felt very, I felt like I knew her. I felt like Mary, even though I never met her, was like a family member and somebody I could really understand. And that felt great because I didn't feel intimidated by the project. And then when I was doing the press for Quant, I was talking to Twiggy on her Tea with Twiggy on her podcast. And I made a joke. I was being cheeky and I said, oh, have you ever thought of someone doing a doc on you? And she was like, oh, yeah, people have asked many, many times, but I'm not sure. And I said, oh, well, look, give me a chance. You know, maybe let me do it. And she goes, oh, yeah, not so sure. But that night she called me and she said, you know, I've just had to think about it. And I loved Quant so much that I'd like you to direct the documentary on me. And it would just happen like that. And then I was doing there was a screening in Leonard-on-Sea of Quant, and there was someone from the BBC there. They loved it. They said, well, we've got a pot of money. And then I went to Film Soho and it literally came together in a few days. The beginning part of putting that film together was amazing. And then it was just a shooting where it stopped and started with certain things that was happening with finance and stuff. But, you know, we got there. And it's being released. And the thing with Twiggy is, you know, I was a model, I was an actress, mm-hmm. I did a fashion designer, I did many things. So I understood how, and also very family is very important. So I understood how important it was to show all the different sides and not exploit her and not sensationalize her life and feel very kind of sensitive to certain things.
Absolutely. And of course, it's getting its premiere this week at the LFF. What does that mean to you as a filmmaker to have something premiere at the LFF?
I think it's, you know, I'm a London girl, Twiggy's a London girl, and, you know, to have my film in the London Film Festival is amazing. There's such great filmmakers there, and, you know, it's really exciting. I'm pretty nervous about it on Friday because it's in the big screen at the NFT. I have lots of friends there, families, and the general public and people in the industry. But, you know, I did the best I could do. I worked really hard and it is what it is. It's like you kind of throw many, many things at it or choose those things and hope you kind of get the right ingredients to make the right doc. I think it means a lot to me. And, you know, I'm looking forward to having a bit of a rest and just kind of sitting back and thinking, what am I going to do next? Because I went from Quant and then the next day I finished Quant, I went to Twiggy. So it's been 5 years back to back without a day off. And now I've got that time, I'm officially unemployed, which is which is great. I can just now kind of really reflect and think what I want to do next.
But you're not exactly down the dole office, are you? Said you're not gonna be signing on.
No, there's been some lovely documentaries been sent to me to maybe do a couple of features I'm developing, one that I'm co-writing, and we have a production company on board. You know, there is lots of lovely opportunities, but I need to know that, you know, I'm so passionate about Quant, so passionate about Twiggy. The next project, I have to feel equally as passionate about. And I've learned so much over the last 3 years on Twiggy and the 2 years before, but I still feel like a beginner, you know, because I was acting and I was producing. I'd never directed. So sometimes I feel a little bit, it's such an odd thing with directing because it really is an intuitive thing. It really comes from you. This kind of passion and how you see something. And it's having that kind of articulation to, you know, to make sure you know, it's all explained to everybody who's your team, and to have a really good team around you. But the more I do, the more I, you know, I understand it's about clear communication and knowing, you know, 100% what you want, which I kind of do most of the time, but there's so much detail. It's very overwhelming, but no, it's such an interesting job, documentary making, you know, directing.
But as you say, you're developing some narrative films as well. But documentary filmmaking, you seem to have taken to it like a duck to water. And it's interesting what you were saying earlier on about reinvention. And one of the reasons that you were drawn to Twiggy was that she was constantly able to reinvent herself, and that was inspirational to you. And this is exactly what you're doing now. I mean, does that mean you're still acting? You're still going to produce as well? Is that the plan, or are you now full time director?
I like to keep things open, but I think directing is, I think, the priority. I will still go and act when there's something that I want to do. I've been offered a play next year, which I thought would be great to go and do some theatre, because I hadn't done some theatre for a while. Mm-hmm. I think with producing, even though I co-produced this, I'm not really driven by producing. I had my own production company before and produced, you know, I think between 5-10 films. And I think for now, I kind of just want to focus on directing and acting. I always change things up because as your life changes and your circumstances change, you do different things. You know, when I was younger, I was acting mainly. Then I had my own fashion label, and that was when the kids were little. It was a good job because I could do things at home. I could design from home. I mean, acting, you'd always have to go on location. That didn't suit me. And the same with directing. When my kids grew up and left home, I suddenly thought, you know, I have my time is my own. And I went, I mean, each time I changed my role, you know, whatever I was doing. So when I was producing, before I went and did a master's at Staffordshire University in production. And then when I, before Quant, I went and studied again at Raindance, documentary filmmaking. And now I'm studying again. I just love going back to school. It's so great, like being my age and being in the classroom. I love it.
Is that weird for other people? Do you get weird glances, weird responses from people when they're, you know, they're at Raindance? They look across and, hang on, is that Sadie Frost?
I think people really like it. I think it's very humbling for me. I think for people, when you kind of, especially, I do a lot of talks about, especially kind of inspirational talks for women, saying that, you know, just because when you're getting older, you don't have to give up. You just, you know, keep focused on your dreams and you can make things happen. I think when I go and do a course, I learn from the people I'm doing the course with. And, you know, I can say, you know, give people encouragement, like, you know, and, you know, I like kind of mentoring people as well. So they help me, I help them. It seems to work. You know, and I love Raindance. It's such a brilliant place. Elliot Grove, who set it up, is just, you know, very important man in my life for helping me get started.
I want to ask one last LFF question, one last London Film Festival question. You know, what's your association been like with it over the years? You say, as a London girl, is it something that's been important in your life?
Yeah, I was, you know, it's one of those things that you always look up to. It's just, you know, it's kind of the definitive festival that I've always kind of been drawn to. I think I was very excited when Quant got into the festival, and there was the premiere then, and everyone I dealt with at the London Film Festival was just so amazing, really encouraging. You know, they kind of understood when I was making Quant, and it was COVID again, how that we stopped and started, and how the film nearly fell apart midway. And I just got, you know, nothing but encouragement from the people and the team there, and the same with Twiggy. It's just nice to see that I'm being supported. You know, it's so easy in any industry to not be supported, but I've had, you know, 100% support. So to have, you know, whatever happens with the film, you know, it will come out in the cinemas the end of Feb, beginning of March. Mm-hmm. Me, you know, to be in this festival means everything.
Amazing. Well, when that happens, end of Feb, March, is an open invitation to come on the podcast and talk about it, Sadie, then. But until then, I wish you all the best, and hope you get better soon.
Thank you.
And that was Sadie Frost, and I really do hope that she got better because her premiere is tonight. But that is it. That is it for our BFI London Film Festival special. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Three very, very different and very, very interesting interviews, I thought. But then what do I know? I'm outrageously biased. There's still time to catch a couple of films and events at the LFF this year. Go to whatson.bfi.org.uk for more info. Otherwise, see you next year. Start queuing now. Thanks for listening. See you next year. Bye.